Hooray!
Good. Now the next toast is in the hands of Adrian Lindsay Mackay.
A toast to kith and kin overseas. Great-grandfather Vinyl, Granny Bunny and Henry Draper, Aunt Mary and Uncle John Kill and Alison and Murray, Aunt Sheila and Uncle Peter Hodgkinson, and Alan and Susie, Ray and Dorian Frev in Nova Scotia, and Jesse Peterson, and many others.
Here.
Now we're having another toast from Kathy.
Spoke at home. Uncle Alan and Aunt Sheila, Robert Andrew and Claire, Great Uncle Bill McClellan, and Aunt Cora and Rogan. Lindsay's everywhere, too. The Donna of the Turkey, Mr. Leslie Lowe, and all the others at home.
Everybody at home.
Did you see Aunt Jessie? Can't Aunt Jessie? Kathy and Adrian are now going to recite a short poem for your pleasure.
Bad Sir Brian Botany.
Sir Brian has a battle up with great big knobs on. Villages and blip them on the head. On Wednesday and on Saturday, but mostly on the latter day, he called at all villages, and this is what he said.
I am Sir Brian.
Ting ding.
I am Sir Brian.
Rat tat.
I am Sir Brian, as bold as a lion. Take that, and that, and that.
Sir Brian has a pair of boots with great big spurs on, a fighting pair of which he was particularly fond. On Tuesday and on Friday, just to make the street look tidy, he'd collect the passing villagers and kick them in the pond.
I am Sir Brian.
Splash.
I am Sir Brian.
Splosh.
I am Sir Brian, as bold as a lion. Is anyone else for a wash?
Sir Brian woke one morning and he couldn't find his battle axe. He walked into the village in his second pair of boots. He had gone 100 paces. When the street was full of faces, and the villagers round him with ironical salutes.
You are Sir Brian.
Indeed.
You are Sir Brian.
Dear, dear.
You are Sir Brian, as bold as a lion. Delighted to meet you here.
Sir Brian went a journey, and he found a lot of duckweed. They pulled him out and dried him, and they blipped him on the head. They took him by the breeches, and they hurled him into ditches, and they pushed him under waterfalls, and this is what they said.
You are Sir Brian.
Don't laugh.
You are Sir Brian.
Don't cry.
You are Sir Brian, bold as a lion. Sir Brian, the lion. Goodbye.
Sir Brian struggled home again and chopped off his battle axe. Sir Brian took his fighting boots and threw them in the fire. He's quite a different person now. He hasn't got his spurs on. And he goes about the village as B. Botany Esquire.
I'm Sir Brian.
Oh no.
I'm Sir Brian.
Who's he?
I haven't got any title. I'm Botany. Plain Mr. Botany B.
Very good. Well done. Are you ready, chaps?
Mm-hmm. Old Father William. You are old, Father William, the young man did say, and your hair has become very white. And yet you instantly stand on your head. Do you think it, at your age, it is right?
In my youth,
Father William replied to his son,
I feared it might injure the brain. But now that I'm perfectly sure, I have none why I do it again and again.
You are old, said the youth, as I mentioned before, and you have grown most uncommonly fat. yet you have turned the back somersault in at the door. Pray, what is the reason of that?
In my youth,
said the sage as he shook his grey locks, I kept all my limbs very supple by the use of this ointment. 1 shilling a box, allow me to sell you a couple.
You are old, said the youth, and your jaws are too weak for anything tougher than sweet. Yet you finished the goose with the bones and the beak. Pray, how did you manage it?
My youth, said his father, I took to the law and argued each case with my wife, and the muscular strength which it gave to my jaw has lasted the rest of my life.
You are old, said the youth. One would hardly suppose that your eye was as steady as ever. Yet you balanced an eel on the end of your nose. What made you so awfully clever?
I've answered to 3 questions, and that is enough, said his father. Don't give yourself airs. Do you think I can listen all day to such stuff? Be off, or I'll kick you downstairs.
Every year, I have this special opportunity of wishing you a happy Christmas. I like to think I'm speaking to each child who can see or hear me, each woman, each man, in every country of the Commonwealth. Christmas is a festival which brings us together in small groups, a family group if we are lucky. Today, we are not just nameless people in a crowd. We meet as friends who are glad to be together and who care about each other's happiness. Nowadays, this is a precious experience. So much of the time we feel that our lives are dominated by great impersonal forces beyond our control. The scale of things and organizations seems to get bigger and more inhuman. We are horrified by brutal and senseless violence. And above all, the whole fabric of our lives is threatened by inflation, frightening sickness of the world today. Then Christmas comes, and once again we are reminded that people matter, and it is our relationship with one another that is most important. For most of us, I wish it could be for everyone, this is a holiday, and I think it's worth reminding ourselves why. We are celebrating a birthday, the birthday of a child born nearly 2,000 years ago, who grew up and lived for only about 30 years. That one person, by his example and by his revelation of the good which is in us all, has made an enormous difference to the lives of people who have come to understand his teaching. His simple message of love has been turning the world upside down ever since. He showed that what people are and what people do does matter and does make all the difference. He commanded us to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. But what exactly is meant by loving ourselves? I believe it means trying to make the most of the abilities we have been given. It means caring for our talents. It is a matter of making the best of ourselves, not just doing the best for ourselves. We are all different, but each of us has his own best to offer. the responsibility for the way we live life, with all its challenges, sadness and joy, is ours alone. If we do this well, it will also be good for our neighbours. If you throw a stone into a pool, the ripples go on spreading outwards. A big stone can cause waves, but even the smallest pebble changes the whole pattern of the water. Our daily actions are like those ripples. Each one makes a difference, even the smallest. It does matter, therefore, what each individual does each day. Kindness, sympathy, resolution, and courteous behavior are infectious. Acts of courage and self-sacrifice, like those of the people who refuse to be terrorized by kidnappers or hijackers, or who defuse bombs, are an inspiration to others. And the combined effects can be enormous. If enough grains of sand are dropped into one side of a pair of scales, they will, in the end, tip it against a lump of lead. We may feel powerless alone, but the joint efforts of individuals can defeat the evils of our time. Together, they can create a stable, free, and considerate society. Like those grains of sand, they can tip the balance. So take heart from the Christmas message and be happy. God bless you all.
That was the Queen's speech on Christmas Day, 1975, and it made me think of the days of her great-grandfather, King Edward VII, when I was a little girl, and we celebrated not Christmas, because Christmas wasn't the family gathering time in Scotland, but New Year. On New Year's Day, we all met together at Applegarth, my grandfather Brown's house. There the aunts and uncles assembled. The aunt, Uncle Willie and Aunt Susan and Aunt Jessie from Woodburn arrived amidst great welcomings and kissings under the mistletoe which hung beside the stuffed capercailzie in the hall. Then when everyone had got settled down and had had a sherry, the great event of the day was the midday dinner. And for that, the menu never varied. We had hare soup, roast goose, plum pudding, a light and flaming mince pies. And I was always privileged to sit next to my grandfather and next to his pet dog, Spot, who had a place at the table with the rest of us. Then the gentlemen retired to the parlour for their cigars and their postprandial nap. The ladies adjourned to the drawing room upstairs, a room which was used only this once in the year for an official occasion. The rest of the year, we associated it with the smell of white heather drying to be sent by my Uncle James to India for the celebration of St. Andrew's Day, and apples picked from the garden. There was a snake in a bottle which intrigued my brother and myself greatly. Well, there we were, all together in the afternoon of New Year's Day. There was fun and games. The usual tricks were played on the aunts and uncles, squeakers under the cushions and mice running around. And then the children were expected to do recitations. I can remember standing up and doing Young Locke and Varus Come Out of the West, and At the Death of Marmion, and my brother doing The Boy Stood on the Burning Bridge. And then we had a wonderful tea downstairs in the dining room. But next door people used to come and join us, Lawyer Brown and his buxom, good-looking wife. Then we had sing-songs at which she always sang, "Caw the Owls to the Nows, My grandfather's dog couldn't stand this and started yowling in the most extraordinary way and had to be hastily removed from the room. So in those days, this was before the First World War, we had plenty to eat and plenty to drink and plenty of fun and games. And the children were always very sorry when it was time for them to go to bed. But before we went to bed, we were allowed to see our great aunts and uncles into the growler, which arrived at the front door to take them back to Woodbine. And so that's a long time ago, before 1910, because King Edward died in that year. But today's speech by the Queen reminded me of those old days, and I thought you in Tasmania might like to remember that the furniture that was in my grandfather's drawing room is now being used by you in your drawing room down under.
Now, Granny, what about giving reading specially for Murray? You've got an old school book of Mary's there. Have you got Horatius?
Yes.
Well,
I've got it open.
Good enough. Well, read it to Murray.
This used to be a great favourite with our family, Murray, and I'm going to read it to you. Lars Porsena of Clausium, by the nine gods he swore that the great house of Tarquin should suffer wrong no more. By the nine gods he swore it and named a trysting day and bade his messengers ride forth east and west and south and north to summon his array. Fast by the royal standard o'erlooking all the war, Lars Porsena of Clausium sat in his ivory car. By the right wheel rode Mamilius, prince of the Latian name, and by the left false Sextus, that wrought the deed of shame. But when the face of Sextus was seen among the foes, a yell that rent the firmament from all the town arose. On the housetops was no woman but spat towards him and hissed, no child but screamed out curses and shook its little fist. But the consul's brow was sad, and the consul's speech was low, and darkly looked he at the wall, and darkly at the foe. Their ban will be upon us before the bridge goes down, and if they once may win the bridge, what hope to save the town? Then out spake brave Horatius, the captain of the gate, to every man upon this earth death cometh soon or late. And how can man die better than facing fearful odds for the ashes of his fathers and the temples of his gods? Hew down the bridge, Sir Consul, with all the speed ye may. I with two more to help me will hold the foe to in play. In yon straight path a thousand may well be stopped by three. Now who will stand on either hand and keep the bridge with me? Then out spake Spurius Lartius, and at Ramenum proud was he. Lo, I will stand at thy right hand and keep the bridge with thee. And out spake strong Herminius, of Titian blood was he. I will abide on thy left side and keep the bridge with thee. Horatius, quoth the consul, as thou sayest, so let it be. And straight against that great array forth went the dauntless three. For Romans in Rome's quarrel spared neither land nor gold, nor son nor wife, nor limb nor life, in the brave days of old. Was none who would be foremost to lead such dire attack, but those behind cried forward, and those before cried back. and backward now and forward wavers the deep array, and on the tossing sea of steel to and forth the standards reel, and the victorious trumpet peal dies fitfully away. Yet one man for one moment stood out before the crowd. Well known was he to all the three, and they gave him greeting loud. Now welcome, welcome, Sextus, now welcome to thy home. Why dost thou stay and turn away? Here lies the road to Rome. Thrice looked he at the city, thrice looked he at the dead, and thrice came on in fury, and thrice turned back in dread. And white with fear and hatred scowled at the narrow way, where wallowing in a pool of blood the bravest Tuscans lay. But meanwhile axe and lever have manfully been plied, and now the bridge hangs tottering above the boiling tide. Come back, Horatius, loud cried the fathers all. Back, Latius, back, Herminius, back, ere the ruin fall. Back darted spurious Latius, Herminius darted back, and as they passed beneath their feet they felt the timbers crack. But when they turned their faces, and on the further shore saw brave Horatius stand alone, they would have crossed once more. But with a crash like thunder fell every loosened beam, and like a dam the mighty wreck lay right athwart the stream. And a long shout of triumph rose from the walls of Rome, as to the highest turret tops was splashed the yellow foam. And like a horse unbroken when first he feels the rein, the furious river struggled hard and tossed his tawny mane, and burst the curb and bounded, rejoicing to be free, and whirling down in fierce career, battlement and plank and pier, rushed headlong to the sea. Alone stood brave Horatius, but constant still in mind. Thrice 30,000 foes before, and the broad flood behind. Down with him, cried false Sextus, with a smile on his pale face. Now yield thee, cried last Porsena, now yield thee to our grace. Round turned he, as not deigning those craven ranks to see. Not spake he to last Porsena, to Sextus not spake he. But he saw on the Palatinus the white porch of his home, and he spake to the noble river that rolls by the towers of Rome. O Tiber, Father Tiber, to whom the Romans pray, a Roman's life, a Roman's arms, take thou in charge this day. So he spake, and speaking, sheathed the good sword by his side, and with his harness on his back, plunged headlong in the tide. No sound of joy or sorrow was heard from either bank, but friends and foes in dumb surprise, with parted lips and straining eyes, stood gazing where he sank. And when above the surges they saw his crest appear, all Rome sent forth a rapturous cry, and even the ranks of Tuscany could scarce forbear to cheer. But fiercely ran the current, swollen high by months of rain, and fast his blood was flowing, and he was sore in pain, and heavy with his armor, and spent with changing blows, and oft they thought him sinking, but still again he rose. Ne'er I winded swimmer in such an evil case struggle through such a raging flood safe to the landing place, but his limbs were borne up bravely by the brave heart within, and our good Father Tiber bore bravely up his chin. Curse on him, quoth false Sextus, will not the villain drown? But for this day, ere close of day, we should have sacked the town. Heaven help him, quoth Lars Porsena, and bring him safe to shore, for such a gallant feat of arms was never seen before. And now he feels the bottom, now on dry earth he stands, now round him throng the fathers to press his gory hands. And now with shouts and clapping, and noise of weeping loud, he enters through the river gate, borne by the joyous crowd. When the oldest cask is opened, and the largest lamp is lit, when the chestnuts glow in the embers, and the kid turns on the spit, when young and old encircle around the firebrand's clothes, when girls are weaving baskets, and the lads are shaping bows, when the good man mends his armor and trims his helmet's plume, when the good wife's shuttle merrily goes flashing through the loom, with weeping and with laughter, still is this story told, how well Horatius kept the bridge in the brave days of old.
War One was, in my youth, a very highly emotional time. One of the poems which always cheered me and strengthened my resolve is called An April Song, written by a forgotten Lance Corporal G.C. Michael of the Royal Engineers while he was on leave at Stratford in Avon. An April Song. Orchard land, damson blossom, primrose broom, Avon like a silver band winds from Stratford down to Broome. All the orchards shimmer white for an April day's delight. We have risen in our might, left this land we love to fight, fighting still that these may stand. Orchard land, orchard land. Running stream, running stream, ruddy tench and silver perch. Shakespeare loved the waters gleam sparkling on by Welford Church. Water fay meet woodland gnome where the silver eddies foam. Through the richly scented loam, we are fain to see our home, see again thy silver gleam, a running stream, a running stream. Silver throat, piping blackbird, trilling thrush, Shakespeare heard your merry note, still you herald morning's blush. You shall sing your anthems grand when we've finished what we planned. God will hear and understand. God will give us back our land where the water lily floats. Silver throat, silver throat. It is strange that I have never seen any reproduction of this lovely short poem since it was printed in 1915. I wonder why it is so completely forgotten. Here is another poem with atmosphere. It was written by my school friend George McKinley in 1916 while he was on manoeuvres in the early morning one day. He noticed a horse on the other side of a hedge as he marched along. Thereafter he wrote this. Knee-deep in grasses, fetlock deep in dew, heart deep in clover, cool and wet, he, the beast of burden, watched us tramp it through, twixt the twining hedgerows, that bounded off his heaven. Layer deep in dust, blasphemy deep in sweat, cool pack and blanket and 100 of Mark 7. Mark 7 was the name given to the rifles, to the rounds which we carried. I will use what remains of this cassette to give you another poem by George McKinley. It was written in 1909. I guess he would only be about 18 or 19 years of age when he wrote it. It is called The Exile. I'm weary for thy gleaming een, I'm hungry for thy voice. I lang to drink thy presence in, and in thy love rejoice. As he way in the desert place, yearns for the shady pool, to drink and rest a while in peace, where palms are hanging cool. The traveller to the fountain flow comes but to gan all, but ginna come to thee, my Joe, I'll bide, nor thirst a flaw. I'll pitch my tente by thy side where love's ain waters be, and there forevermore abide, till death twine thee and me. You'll probably say I'm quite an old romantic. Well, I admit it. The following poem by Emily Bronte has interested me ever since my school days. I give it to you without comment. No coward soul is mine, no trembler in the world's storm-troubled sphere. I see heaven's glories shine and faith shines equal, arming me from fear. O God within my breast, almighty ever-present deity, life that in me has rest, as I, undying life, have power in thee. Vain are the thousand creeds that move men's hearts, unutterably vain, worthless as withered reeds, or idlest froth amid the boundless main. To waken doubt in one holding so fast by thy infinity, so surely anchored on the steadfast rock of immortality. With wide embracing love, thy spirit animates eternal years, pervades and broods above, changes, sustains, dissolves, creates, and rears. Though earth and moons were gone, and suns and universes ceased to be, and thou were left alone, every existence would exist in thee. There is no room for death, nor atom that his might could render void, since thou art being and breath, and what thou art may never be destroyed. I enjoy the confidence of that coin. It has in it some resemblances to my other favourite, Robert Brown. I am conscious I have not acquired a very high degree of competence in the use of this tape recorder. Perhaps with the next cassette I will do better. We lack a good mechanism for showing how much time has been spent in the recording and how much is still available for further recordings. This is the 21st of September, a glorious sunlit morning. I have been out sawing wood from the dead elm tree in front of the house. Margaret at the moment has gone to church,
and I am alone in the lounge. We've had quite an exciting week in one way or another. We went on Friday to Birmingham University, where we heard Murray give an important centenary lecture in connection with the celebrations of that university. On Tuesday next, we expect to see Sheila from California. That will be a great thrill too. Two nights ago I had the great pleasure of addressing a gently argumentative letter to Alison in Tasmania on the subject of poetry. We do not agree altogether on who are the best poets, but it is great fun nonetheless to write to her. This morning I have addressed a little piece of paper to Kathy, asking her if she knows the difference between a collision and an explosion. After a collision, we say, "Well, here we are." But after an explosion, we say, "Ah, where are we?" Of course, I've sent something at the same time to young Adrian. I sent him a limerick, which I have no doubt is about his literary level at the moment. Well, Margaret's due back any time from church, and she's bringing Jessie for lunch. There's not very much left of this cassette for recording purposes, but I will turn them on to it when they come in.
We had bramble and apple pie for lunch, minus of day and Abersoft. And we went out hunting the hedgerows and came back with our brambles, and Auntie Jessie made our famous bramble and apple pie. In the afternoon, Jessie and I went to Claverley, one of the prettiest villages in Shropshire, and we went to a flower show in the village hall, where little children had little posies and wrote plays, dahlias and chrysanthemums and roses. It's been one of the most wonderful summers we've ever had. And now the trees are turning to autumn colours. Our humour in the garden is beautiful. This evening, your father and I, Mary, have been reading Browning's poems, and we're glad, Alison, that your copy, your mother and your copy that you gave us of modern poems, has some of Browning's poems in it. And now we come to the end of a day, a famous day, a very interesting day it seems, and we think that our daughter Sheila is crossing the Atlantic at this very moment and will be in London tomorrow morning, Monday, the 22nd of September. So we send you with this cassette our greetings from Wolverhampton and wish you in the antipodes a beautiful a summer when it comes after as we have had. Good night.
24 hours later, the scene is as before, except that it is evening and the lights are now on. Margaret has gone out, beautifully dolled up in a magnificent hairstyle, to the magistrate's dinner. She is wearing the golden chain and the pendant which you gave her so kindly to mark her 75th birthday, and our golden wedding. I have to report that we had a call tonight from Sheila, who has arrived safely from California and who sounds splendid. She speaks very clearly indeed. We also had a visit today from Alan and Robert. They had come more or less direct from Iona and were going on to London to meet Rogan tonight. How this family gets around, I don't understand it. Now, we've only about 2 minutes left on this recorder, and I suppose we'll fill up the time by reciting to you a poem you all remember, A Shropshire Lad, by John Betjeman. The gas was on in the institute, the flare was up in the gym, a man was running a mineral line, a lass was singing a hymn, when Captain Webb, the dolly man, Captain Webb from Dolly, came swimming along in the old canal that carries the bricks to Lolly. Swimming along, swimming along, swimming along from the Severn, and paying a call at the Jolly Bank while swimming along to heaven. The sun shone low on the railway line and over the brick and stack, and in at the window upstairs at the Dolly House's back, when we saw the ghost of Captain Webb, Webb in a water sheeting, come dripping along in a bathing dress to the Saturday evening meeting. Dripping along, dripping along to the congregational hall, dripping, and still he goes over the sill and fades away in the wall. There wasn't a man in Oaken Gate that hadn't got hold of the tail, and over the valley in Ironbridge and round by Coldbrook Dale, how Captain Webb, the dolly man, Captain Webb from Dolly, rose rigid and dead from the old canal that carries the bricks to Lolly, rigid and dead to the Saturday congregation, paying a call at Jolly Bank on his way to his destination. That poem's modern and good. It has a grand rhythm, a grand swing.